Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The shooting and killing of Michael Brown, a black, unarmed 18-year-old in Ferguson, Missouri, has reignited the debate about racial profiling and the militarization of police forces across the country. Over the past week, we've seen scenes of largely peaceful protests met with excessive militarized police actions. Photos being widely shared on social media show very little difference between police in Ferguson and U.S. soldiers at the height of the occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Images show officers in Ferguson wearing Kevlar vests, camouflage, and armed with shotguns, automatic rifles, and tear gas. So where are local and state police departments getting their Humvees, their military gear, and their M16s? Well, these agencies are eligible to receive surplus military equipment through the Defense Department's 1033 program. And the motto for that program is From War Fighter to Crime Fighter. The program has transferred more than $4 billion worth of military equipment to law enforcement since 1997. That's according to the Defense Logistics Agency's Law Enforcement Support Office. According to a recent ACLU report, last year the Department of Homeland Security pumped $1 billion into local law enforcement. So to get a better understanding of the transformation and militarization of the U.S. police force, we're joined by G.W. Schultz, an investigative reporter who focuses on Homeland Security and these issues for the Center for Investigative Reporting. And he joins us from Austin, Texas. Hi, G.W. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And we're joined by Daniel Newman, president and co-founder of MapLight, a nonpartisan nonprofit revealing money's influence on politics. MapLight is out with a new paper called Defense Industry-Backed Lawmakers Voted to Continue Police Militarization Program. And Daniel joins us from Berkeley. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you. So I want to start off by playing a clip that's getting a lot of attention. Last night in Ferguson, police were tear gassing citizens and telling journalists to leave. CNN reporter Jake Tapper is in Ferguson, and he was actually shocked by what he saw. So let's play a clip. This is Jake Tapper on CNN.
The protesters, here's this main intersection. The protesters have moved all the way down there. They're about half a block down here. John, watch with me. They're all the way down there, okay? Nobody's threatening anything. Nobody's doing anything. None of the stores here that I can see are being looted. There's no violence. Now, I want you to look at what is going on in Ferguson, Missouri, in downtown America, okay? These are armed police. With not machine guns, with semi-automatic rifles, with batons, with shields, many of them dressed for combat. Now, why they're doing this, I don't know. Because there is no threat going on here, none, that merits this. There is none, okay? Absolutely, there have been looters. Absolutely, over the last 9 days, there's been violence. But there is nothing going on this street right now that merits this scene out of Bagram. Nothing. So if people wonder why the people of Ferguson, Missouri, are so upset, this is part of the reason. What is this? This doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is a clip from CNN. Jake Tapper was on the streets of Ferguson last night, for the most part dumbfounded by what he saw. And GW, I wanted to play that clip because it's been getting a lot of attention. People saying, look, even CNN is shocked by what they're seeing. What is your take on that? What's your reaction?
I mean, it's a good question. CNN covers a lot of issues day to day. For folks who've been covering criminal justice for a long time, some of the equipment being used, protective gear being used, it's deployed every day in America in war and executions. And one of the questions there is when that type of equipment that might be startling a lot of people in the streets of Ferguson now should be used in things like war and executions if the criminal suspect isn't known to have a violent history. A lot of these types of deployments we don't see on the news nor do we have good data nationally on how often this type of equipment is deployed. And that may be something down the road that Congress looks at and starts something that starts to trouble people as they learn that this doesn't amount to a rare moment. Even though the images we're seeing are seemingly rare, the types of equipment we're seeing aren't necessarily rare in terms of how often they're used by police in the United States.
Right, and the other thing that we're seeing on social media, it's very effective. Mashable has photos of the police in Ferguson alongside soldiers at the height of the occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan. And other than, you know, the buildings in the background, you really can't see a difference between what the cops and the soldiers look like. Daniel, have these images surprised you? I mean, you know, we'll talk with you about following the money, but first off, what are your thoughts on what we're seeing coming out of Ferguson?
Well, it's certainly surprising, and I think one of the things that's so interesting about it is that this program has received now heightened attention that you mentioned, the 1033 program that actually puts military weapons in the hands of local police. So now we see what's happening in this one city in Missouri, and I think it makes all of us, or at least certainly me here in the Bay Area, and I know people across the country are thinking, wow, is this possible in my police department, in my community?
Right. And since 9/11, $43 billion in federal government grants have been spent on this high-tech combat-ready gear. GW, is there much oversight here? Is there a place we can go to find out where all of this stuff is being sent?
So that's a good question. When it comes to the 1033 program, there's fairly good data available now for the public to scrutinize. We're seeing a lot of reporters who are analyzing this data now. When we tried to tackle it back in 2012, we had a much more difficult time. We were only able to get data agency by agency for the state of California. We'd initially requested from the Defense Logistics Agency national data. It took us months just to get California, so we decided to focus on California and highlight this program as an avenue through which police were able to obtain this type of equipment, in addition to the billions in Homeland Security grants that communities have been eligible for many years now. And one thing that really intrigued us when we got the data in California was that the previous year, communities in California had requested more of this equipment than at any time in the program's history, and the program dated back to the 1990s.
So is there a place where the public can find this information? Because, you know, people this morning were saying if this can happen in Ferguson, I mean, what would happen if this broke out in San Francisco or Oakland, for example?
Well, definitely our website. We have an interactive up on our website showcasing data that we were able to get from California, but it's dated back to 2012 now. So the New York Times, an organization called Muckrock, and others have been making the raw data available state by state that people can go in and parse and analyze and drill down into their own community. The same can't be done with Homeland Security grants. We had huge difficulties trying to figure out state by state and community by community specifically what Homeland Security grants were being spent on. In some areas of the country, we were having a fair amount of success. In other areas, we were able to get very little documentation, if anything at all.
And law enforcement in St. Louis County, with a population of about 1 million, have received $500,000 worth of equipment, including 7 Humvees and M16s. How does this compare to other areas, I mean, municipalities across the country?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
It's hard to tell. It's up to the communities. It's up to police in these communities to decide what they think they need or want. I mean, it's a lot of the equipment is free, more or less, from this surplus program. Things like helicopters, you can't call them free because that's going to cost your department maintenance dollars, operation dollars for years to come. But it's hard. I think it's hard for some communities to pass up these opportunities when it requires is filling out a bunch of paperwork in which you're promising to do certain minimal things like take care of the equipment, or promising that you have a need for it in the case of Homeland Security grants. A lot of communities had a hard time passing up those dollars. So what we really saw with Homeland Security grants is even if we couldn't get rich, raw data on how the money was being spent, during the time we were reporting stories on Homeland Security grants, what we saw was community after community articulating a narrative for why they needed the equipment. There was a perception after 9/11 that the threat landscape had changed and that everyday criminals had become sort of a super threat. What we saw was communities pointing to the infamous North Hollywood bank robbery of the 1990s, in which two individuals used a significant amount of firepower and protective gear to battle police in the street. To this day, we still see police citing that episode as a justification for using a lot of this type of equipment. The shootings in Mumbai, India, the mall shootings in Kenya, these types of events, when you talk to police around the country, they all point to these events as something that could potentially be replicated in their communities. Now, what security experts call these events are high-consequence, low-probability events, like 9/11. It dealt a psychic blow to the country, but they're also extremely uncommon events. However, in the wake of 9/11, Congress appropriated huge sums of money for spending on homeland security. So if police departments are prioritizing homeland security and events like the Mumbai shooting and training around that, that's where the focus, the attitude's going to be, that's where the training's going to be, that's where the equipment's going to be. And that means always when you invest that way, you're sacrificing something else. You could be sacrificing community-oriented policing or foot patrols. You could be sacrificing any number of other things that at one time in law enforcement history, say in the 80s and 90s, was considered important but had been swept aside because of the perception that there was a new threat.
And that is G.W. Schultz, an investigative reporter who focuses on these issues for the Center for Investigative Reporting. We're also joined by Daniel Newman, president of MapLight, a nonprofit revealing money's influence on politics. And in about 10 minutes or so, we'll be joined by Stephen Downing, a retired LAPD deputy chief and board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And today we are talking about the militarization of police forces across the countries. There's so many photos now that are being shared on social media, and I played the clip earlier of Jake Tapper of CNN, who's in Ferguson, who was dumbfounded by what he saw. Police in riot gear in Ferguson, tear gas. They're actually telling journalists to leave the area. And so what questions do you have about the militarization of police forces? What's really struck you about what you've seen over the last week? If you work in law enforcement, how is this changing law enforcement and the way that police operate? That angle is now getting a lot more attention. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And do you know if your law enforcement agency has any of this equipment? Daniel, I wanted to also ask you about this 1033 program. Can you talk a little bit about what do we need to know about this? MapLight reports that in June, the House voted on an amendment from Representative Alan Grayson that sought to partially defund this program. The amendment failed on a bipartisan vote of 62 to 355.
Yeah, so we took that vote to defund the program in part, and we compared it to how much did each U.S. representative received from the defense industry in campaign contributions. And we found that the representatives that voted to continue funding this program received on average 73% more money from the defense industry compared to the representatives voting to defund it.
And so can you elaborate on that? I mean,
yeah.
How much money are we talking about? Where are these representatives getting their money specifically?
Sure.
You write about aerospace contractors, electronic contractors, weapons systems, and ground-based companies.
Yeah, so of course, just the background here, if you want to get elected to Congress or anywhere in this country, you need a lot of money to run for office. And the number one place to get that money is from interest groups that want them something from government. The defense contractors that are a big contributor to politics, the defense contractors in general have invested $200 million in campaign contributions to lawmakers over the last 25 years. And so that creates a relationship with these lawmakers. It helps lawmakers that are favorable to the industry get into office as well. And so what's interesting about this is what's happening in Ferguson, and then what's happening with the militarization of police across the country is really driven by Congress's decision to have this program that allows the federal government, the Defense Department, the Defense Department of Homeland Security, to give this military equipment to local police departments. And then this correlation that we found here at MapLight shows that the defense industry is having an influence on congressional decisions. And I think that's problematic because there are many reasons for that lawmakers might be in favor of this program, but the fact that there's a correlation between how they vote and the money shows that even if no one changes their vote in Congress, defense industry lawmakers are more likely to get elected, and that these decisions are not being made only in what's best for American citizens, but these companies that earn profits from this equipment are also playing a role in the decision.
Right, and we'll actually talk about the companies also later in the show. The MapLight report says that 59 representatives received more than $100,000 from the weapons industry from January 1st, 2011 to December 31st, 2013, and of those, only four supported defunding the 1033 program. And again, the 1033 program allows the Defense Logistics Agency under the DOD to transfer military equipment to civilian police.
It does, and so that's, again, an example of the correlation. If you look at those 59 representatives that received the most money from the defense industry, every single one of them except four voted for this program. And this is pretty typical of congressional votes. Like, it doesn't correlate with every person about how they vote and how much money they get. But if you look at it in the aggregate, how Congress votes is highly correlated with the side that gives them the most money. And it's especially important in this case, as I mentioned, because like, Congress does have a role here in what's happening in our local police departments, and the defense industry is influencing them.
GW, what strikes you about this when you look at how politicians vote and how much money they get from this industry?
I mean, so much of this has to do with definitely the influence of money. And the other element in all this is where the zeitgeist is at, where the public's attitude is at. Now we're seeing rumblings in Congress about potentially scaling this program back. 2 months ago, we weren't hearing anything about that. A year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when we were reporting on some of this data and reporting on these programs and talking to law enforcement experts about the potential threat of police militarization, there weren't those types of rumblings in Congress. In fact, just last year, Congress was taking steps to expand this program to border authorities and make the 1033 program to border authorities and make surplus military equipment coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan available to authorities on the border, where there was perceived to be a new dynamic, a new threat that didn't exist even 10 or 20 years ago. So it was a totally different conversation. And in a matter of days, when the public started to show a lot of really deep frustrations around the images that were coming out of Ferguson, that was when you saw Washington start to react. Now we're hearing comments from Obama and other influential, like, senior lawmakers who are talking about this stuff. But that wasn't the case a short time ago. It wasn't the case with other law officer-involved shootings. This one has just really struck a chord. And one thing that just intrigued me about a lot of the public's reaction is some of this is apolitical. People across the political spectrum, Americans, I think, are expressing worry about the direction of law enforcement and direction of policing in the United States. And I think there's something that's less political and more of an American ideal in that conversation.
You also have Democratic Congressman Hank Johnson of Georgia saying that he plans to introduce legislation when Congress returns in September to curb what he describes as an increasing militarization of police agencies across the country. This is according to the Associated Press. GW, what are your thoughts on a bill like this? I mean, I know that Grayson wanted to curb the spending, and it sounds like Congressman Johnson wants to do something similar.
We'll have to see what the bill looks like, how something like that would be articulated, but never underestimate the power of the police lobby in the United States. They have a significant voice in Washington. The rank and file of lobbying organizations that represent police interests, they vote. And then at the state and local level as well, don't underestimate the power of police unions at that level as well. So even if a local mayor or governor were to take steps to try to demilitarize police along the lines of some formula that could possibly work, it's likely that unions that represent the interests of rank-and-file police and police departments are going to step up and raise questions about whether or not that makes police officers less safe in their day-to-day jobs. These are things that have to be taken into consideration with any bill proposed like that during the heat of the moment when there's a significant amount of media attention on the story. People who watch Congress know that The vast majority of the bills that are proposed never go anywhere. They never get passed. So, you know, if it makes it out of a few committees, then I'll pay a little closer attention.
Daniel, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with GW that when the media is on Congress, that's when they're most likely to act, and that most bills don't get passed. And the question is, what are the long-term forces here? And unfortunately, even though citizens are the ones that elect members of Congress and pay their salaries and pay for all this equipment through our taxes, it's actually the defense contractors that have the tighter lobbying relationship. So it's going to take a lot more than a few media events to really make this change.
And MapFlight reported that the politicians that voted not to defund this program got about $51,000, 73% more than those who voted to defund it. They got about almost $30,000. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's for 2013 to 2014.
That's right. And one of the things that I think is maybe surprising to people is how little these dollars are compared to the billions of dollars that's what's at stake.
But that was my next question.
Yeah, this is a consequence of our broken system of how we elect lawmakers, which is they have to grovel at the feet of these special interest groups basically to get the money to get elected. So we end up with elected officials that are running our whole government, are making the laws that govern us, are deciding what military equipment is in our local police departments, and they're very dependent on these campaign checks to get elected. So until we change that system and have public funding of elections and other things that some other states have, we're going to be stuck in that dynamic.
Well, let's take a few calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Joseph in Berkeley. Hi, Joseph.
Yes, good morning. You know, what I think is just as important as the militarization of the police is that often the DAs, with all due respect, the mainstream media, and many of the judges, too, let cops, regardless of color, get away with lies that cops get away with repeatedly, and either literally or in effect get away with murder in their reports or on the stand. I had a case with Oakland Judge Elizabeth Hendrickson, and I felt like I was before a small town judge, a white small town judge in Mississippi when I was before Judge Henderson in Oakland. And this is where the cops are held to a lower legal standard than anyone else. And this is something that former San Jose Police Chief Joseph McNamara wrote about in the L.A. Times as far back as February 11, 1996, where he talked about police testifying or police perjury. So when in all these cases, you know, these elements of the judicial system and the mainstream media let these cops know that they can lie with impunity, especially in these cases where I repeatedly say, in any controversial police case, unless there is independent, objective, corroborating evidence, we must assume that the cops are lying about something critical.
Well, Joseph, we have to go to quick break, but GW has been following these issues for years, and so I will ask him to comment right after we come back. GW Schultz is an investigative reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Daniel Newman is president and co-founder of MapLight, a nonprofit revealing money's influence on politics. Their latest report is called Ferguson Defense Industry-Backed Lawmakers Voted to Continue Police Militarization Program. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. And then after the break, we'll also be joined by Stephen Downing, retired LAPD deputy chief and board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. So if you have specific questions for someone who used to work for the LAPD, we'd love to hear from you and your overall thoughts on the militarization of police forces. It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling toll-free 866-798-TALK. Toll-free 866-798-8255. Or you can post your comment or question on our website, yourcallradio.org. The email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Then at noon today, John Perry and Ken Taylor, Philosophy Talk. Stay tuned.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with students who are defying the odds by graduating from college. These are young people who come from poor and low-income families. We often hear about technology in the classroom. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg recently committed $120 million to Bay Area schools, but these students say what they really need are mentors. So what else do they need? That is tomorrow, and then Thursday we'll be joined by Joshua Horowitz, author of the new book, War of the Whales. It tells the story of how an environmental attorney stumbles on one of the Navy's best-kept secrets, a submarine surveillance system that floods entire ocean basins with high-intensity sound. That's Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the militarization of police forces across the country. This is getting a lot of attention in the aftermath of the shooting and killing of Michael Brown, a black unarmed 18-year-old in Ferguson, Missouri. Over the past week, we have seen scenes of largely peaceful protests met with excessive militarized police actions. We're seeing officers in Kevlar vest, camouflage. They're armed with automatic rifles and tear gas. And so today we're talking about this, specifically this 1033 program, which has transferred more than $4 billion worth of military equipment to law enforcement since 1997. We're joined by Daniel Newman, president of MapLight. They follow the money. And G.W. Schultz is an investigative reporter who focuses on these issues for the Center for Investigative Reporting. G.W., would you respond to Joseph's call about how the media report on police forces, specifically when we're talking about killings and violence? And he says that they're rarely held accountable. And actually, the data shows that cops rarely ever are charged with, crimes when it comes to killing someone.
Yeah, and it's a good point. I mean, in recent days, we've seen a surge of attention paid to law enforcement. But it's worth keeping in mind, when we say the phrase law enforcement, we don't just mean patrol officers on the street. We mean homicide inspectors. We mean district attorneys, county-level prosecutors, federal prosecutors. Every step of the way in these institutions, there's an opportunity for criminal justice to fail. And there's also an opportunity for the public to demand reform. So the other 48 weeks of the year when less attention is being paid to some of these issues may be the more critical time for the public to be demanding institutional changes where citizens' lives are interacting with criminal justice institutions, where police are testifying, for instance, where even on the civil litigation side, where a family take steps to sue a police department to redress grievances after a loved one has been killed by police. That's an opportunity for a system to deliver justice. And it's an opportunity or a dimension of the criminal justice system that often goes overlooked and is not reported on. It definitely not as aggressively as the reporting we're seeing in the last few days.
Well, I'd like to welcome our next guest. Stephen Downing is a retired LAPD deputy chief and board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. We just got a call from a listener who feels like the media don't do a really good job of covering these issues. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that, specifically when it involves a police officer killing an unarmed citizen.
Well, I think in the case of this Ferguson situation, the media coverage has effectively been a godsend because this kind of problem, the militarization of police, has been festering for too many years. Now we have Mr. Holder and Mr. Obama's attention, and they're saying all the right things, but what they have to do is they have to go back to Washington and end the militarization of police. Stop handing out this kind of equipment with no standards. I'm not saying that the law enforcement should not have this kind of equipment, but it shouldn't be in the hands of small police departments like in Missouri right now.
Well, as a retired LAPD deputy chief, how is the militarization of these forces changing the culture of these forces and the power of the men who are wearing this riot gear?
The culture, you're exactly right. It is changing the culture because American law enforcement are supposed to be peace officers. The military is trained and their culture is completely different. And that's why the military is not allowed on American soil. The military has enemies and they're trained to kill their enemies. Law enforcement has no enemies. The worst criminal that law enforcement comes up against is an individual who is entitled to the protection of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And this is what the militarization of American law enforcement, especially in small cities across the country, has resulted in this warrior culture, this warrior attitude where compassion and engagement and negotiation is no longer part of the formula. You look at a city like Los Angeles, who is highly trained in SWAT. That equipment stays in the barn until specific standards exist. And when it rolls with the intent of preserving life, not taking an enemy out.
Well, how do police forces determine when to bring this out? Because, I mean, it's been, even, you know, CNN reporters are saying it's shocking to see guys in riot gear with tear gas and semis point their weapons at unarmed citizens with their hands up who pose no obvious threat.
The standard, that's exactly what I'm saying. The standards, like you look at the Los Angeles Police Department, that kind of equipment does not leave the barn until certain standards are met. And those standards are active shooters, barricaded suspects, situations in which the criminal is armed, and the behavior of the criminal is beyond the capacity of the first responder. So you don't have that presence on the streets, that military presence on the streets, unless it is absolutely needed. And when the situation is over, they go back to the barn, that equipment stays there, and you do not see a policeman on the street in combat gear in Los Angeles. And the problem in Missouri is that's the first thing you saw. Somebody started protesting a little bit, and the first thing you see is this big rollout of military force, and that is going to enrage a community, especially when the police department has no reservoir of goodwill in place, and it's clear that that town did not.
That is Stephen Downing, retired LAPD deputy chief and board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We're also joined by G.W. Schultz, an investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting, and Daniel Newman, president of MapLight, a nonprofit revealing money's influence on politics. And we've got full lines. We'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255. We are talking about the militarization of police forces across the country. What questions do you have? What reaction are you having to the scenes that we're seeing in Ferguson, Missouri? If you work for law enforcement, we'd love to hear from you. How is this changing the culture of the force? You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Jeff in Berkeley. Hi, Jeff.
Morning. I'm going to switch my question a little bit. The last guest pretty much answer the corporate culture and the kind of people that get hired and get retained. But here's another one. Mr. Brown in Ferguson was shot 6 times. Andy Lopez was shot 8. You think a 40-millimeter handgun, which is a powerful handgun, one shot should take somebody out. But why do they keep shooting and shooting and shooting and emptying their clip? Answer that, because that is very disturbing.
And Andy Lopez is the boy in Santa Rosa who was shot? I believe a 13-year-old? Okay. Well, thank you for calling. Stephen, do you want to take that question?
Based on the audio, I couldn't hear it.
Our caller wanted to know why, in the case of Michael Brown, why was he shot 6 times? I mean, why is it that people are shot multiple times?
That's a good question, and the answer is a very complex one. A number of years ago, there was a Supreme Court decision that resulted in a change in training across the country. Now, this is only in my opinion, but we used to teach in the academies what we call escalation and de-escalation of force. and that when you perceive that the threat of deadly force passes, you're supposed to de-escalate. But the nature of this Supreme Court decision and the training that followed, I believe, has resulted in more and more, not so many more shootings, but within the shootings themselves, more shots fired. And you see that more and more today in police shootings, where there's many, many more shots fired. Now, in that particular situation in Ferguson, I don't have an answer because I haven't seen the police investigation. I haven't seen the results of that. But six shots is a lot of shots. Mm-hmm. Especially when someone's not armed. And it could very well go to the officer's training. If you take a look at Henderson and see when they go to the range and qualify, when those targets turn, how many times do the officers fire? Do they fire once and assess the damage, or do they empty their revolvers or empty their guns and then see what happens? So I think it's really a function of training, and I think the deadly force training across this country and policies within police departments really, really needs a hard look.
Well, I wanted to make sure I got my information right about Andy Lopez. In October, sheriff's deputies in Santa Rosa shot and killed 13-year-old Andy Lopez, who was holding a pellet gun. So thanks again for calling in, Jeff. Let's go next to Margaret in Salinas. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for hosting this. I'm in Salinas, as you've mentioned, and in a four-month period, we had four officer-involved shootings on Latinos, which, by the way, I will mention, it's not just African-Americans or black people that are being targeted. Basically, it's people of color from what we see. And, you know, they immediately go into a character assassination on these victims. One victim in particular was caught on video. The whole thing was caught on video, and that was put out in social media. So they immediately sort of went into this trying to defend their point. But, you know, they roll out this military equipment for National Night Out. They let our children play on this stuff. And I think that this equipment also sort of gives them this false sense of empowerment that makes them feel a little bit bigger than they should. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, instead of being for people, they tend to think they're against the people. I wanted to, but, you know, looking at the police policies that exist, for example, with the use of deadly force, I find that the policies are I'm sure have a lot of the union has a big hand in writing those policies, but the language that exists within those policies, basically they give an officer an out for every circumstance, and in the end, it's almost as if none of the above apply, then you know anything applies kind of language.
Well,
in other words,
Margaret, thanks for calling. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we have full lines, and I want to go through a few more calls, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Rose.
Hi.
And Mr. Newman, Mr. Schultz, and Mr. Downey. I just want to say that the Constitution doesn't have anything in it about keeping us safe. And, of course, the old Ben Franklin quote goes, those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. And I just want more information, too, on this Grayson bill that came down for a vote on the 1033 program. If you have the number and the date when that happened, so I can find out what our local Congress people did. But I just think this total police state is out of control. And we saw this in the Occupy movement as well. The use of heavy weapons and police brutality and the RoboCop image that comes down to really squash the freedom of speech and to make people afraid to go out in the streets. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Daniel, do you want to take that one?
Sure. I can tell you, if you go to the MapLight homepage, it's maplight.org,
And there's this report, it's on the, there's a defense industry militarization, and there's a link to that vote, and you can get the date and all the details. But I do actually have the records of how our local law, Bay Area lawmakers voted. And we had actually five Bay Area lawmakers voted to continue funding this police militarization program. Nancy Pelosi actually voted to keep funding the program. Jared Huffman, Mike Thompson, John Garamendi, and Eric Swalwell, all five of those voted to keep funding this police militarization program.
And can we find out which weapons companies give money to Nancy Pelosi at your website?
You absolutely can at the maplight.org site.
Okay, great. And that's also at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for calling in, Andy. Quickly, Stephen, the police union has come up a few times. Our guests say that because the police union is so strong, we might not get a bill to defund 1033. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are is that they're exactly right. Police unions, not just police unions, but organizations like the International Chiefs of Police, organizations in California like the Chiefs Organization, organizations like the Narcotic Officers Association, all of these organizations are protecting the flow of money that comes into their coffers. The militarization 1033 is just one of many. There's the COP grants, there's the burn grants, there's the asset seizure legislation that lets police seize property and keep it without charging anybody with a crime. And all of those things are really on the table to be taken off the table. But our politicians continue to listen to these police unions and to these police organizations. And what I say is that their credibility across the country generally, this is a general statement, but their credibility is so bad today that politicians should stop listening to them. The people are speaking in many, many areas. Medical marijuana, for example, in this state, they spoke 18 years ago. And law enforcement has fought it. They've lied about it. They've used fear tactics to sway city councils and county councils and the state legislature. And what I say, it's time to stop listening to these organizations and listen to the professionals in the organizations. Listen to those chiefs across the country who believe that they have an obligation to accommodate the will of the people.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. As retired LAPD deputy chief, what are you hearing from your colleagues? I mean, do they want this equipment? Is this something they welcome? Is there any backlash against this?
Well, you know, my greatest familiarity is with the Los Angeles Police Department and their SWAT program, and I think if you want to look at an example of how something should be done, look there. If you want an example of how uses of force should be investigated, look there. If you want an example of transparency and communication with the community, look there. Now, come over to the little town I live in next door to Los Angeles, Long Beach. They have no transparency. They have excessive force is taking place all of the time. Here last November, we had a mentally ill woman in a two-hour standoff on the street. SWAT was nowhere to be seen, but the big armored vehicle that I saw a few months earlier in the Christmas parade as a show of, I guess, a show of their force and what they can deliver to our community at a time of goodwill on earth. That armored vehicle was parked there, and it was never used once to screen an approach to the woman or to use its armored ports to deliver a non-lethal chemical like pepper spray or something like that. It was never used. And yet they kept calling her out. And when she finally came out, she had this pistol that turned out to be a BB gun. Five officers fired at her multiple times. And that is a demonstration of a total lack of command and control, the failure to designate one shooter. Again, it's the point that you made earlier, multiple shots fired. And so it's training, 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 and policies that are transparent to the community.
That is Stephen Downing, retired LAPD Deputy Chief and Board Member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Daniel Newman is President of MapLight, a nonprofit revealing money's influence on politics. And G.W. Schultz is an investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. And just quickly, G.W., before we take a few more calls, because this is now getting so much attention, I mean, you've been writing about this for years. Do you see things changing? I mean, what would it take to change this?
This isn't going to sound like the sexiest public policy response in the world, but data and information is so essential, not just for journalists, but for everybody else. Good public policy starts with good data. The sooner we have greater information about how often this type of equipment that's now troubling a lot of people is used, how often tactical units are deployed, and why, what types of warrant executions are used for, good national data on these types of things could unravel bad or poorly defended arguments in other directions. So we have good data nationally, for instance, on when law enforcement officers are killed in the line of duty, but we still don't have reliable national data on how often our civilians are killed by police, let alone how often these specialized units or tactical units are utilized. In the state of California in particular, there's a great challenge for journalists when it comes to getting information on individual shootings. Mm-hmm. In the past, I used to work at the San Francisco Bay Guardian. There were officer-involved shootings that I covered there in which it took us years sometimes to get core information about what happened at the time of the shooting, what was going on, and the press otherwise had to rely on a local police to decide what would be distributed to the public and what wouldn't. And after long periods of time passed, after that initial period when an investigation needs to take place, there needs to be a time period at which government releases more information, like a deadline. And if police can't come up with a good reason to justify withholding the information, then that deadline could trigger the release of certain types of information, like internal investigations from local DAs or from senior brass if they conducted their own investigation. That stuff could be released on a timetable.
We've got an email from Carol who says, let's hope this effort gets further than gun control after Newtown, talking about demilitarizing the police. Thank you for the email, Carol. Let's hear from a few more callers, Jerry and Indigo. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, thank you. I was calling about the way somebody used that this equipment was free. Hello?
Yes. That's right.
And it's not free. You know, this comes from the Defense Department, and the Defense Department has a blank check. And you got bipartisan support in Congress for the defense. Nobody will speak out against the Defense Department. It's just like what's happening in Iraq now. And the neocons, when they first went into Iraq, the neocons was behind that. It had nothing to do with 9/11, but yet they sent all this military equipment and everything to Iraq, and then now they got it going on again in Iraq, and nobody questions the Defense Department and the apparatus that's around the president, so he can't make the correct decisions because they're making all decisions on the ground about the threat to national interest. How is this a threat to our national interest? What's happening in Iraq now? But
well, thank you for calling, Jerry. We're almost out of time, and you brought up a good point here. Daniel, you follow the money in terms of looking at the politicians who vote to continue this flow of weapons, who receive money from the weapons industry. But what about the weapons industry? What role are they playing in all of this? Mondawis has a story that took a look at the tear gas. And the company that supplies the Israeli army with tear gas is the same company supplying the police in Ferguson. Yes Magazine also reporting on this. It's Combined Tactical Systems. Is this getting much attention? Is there a way to follow that money trail?
Well, you have there's a lot of different companies involved, but there's some really huge ones like the Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing are the top three contributors in to Congress in defense contributions, and I think you know, the defense companies here, it's been raised as like, what's their motive here in terms of how do they benefit, if at all, from these local police departments getting this equipment? And I think that it's been put forward that it creates more of a market for these local police with spare parts and buying potentially more of these weapons, but also probably more significantly, the Defense Department, it kind of cleans out their inventory, so then they have kind of space to go back to Congress and say, well, we want more money to buy more weapons.
Hmm. Well, we will put this link on our website. Weapons fired in Ferguson come from companies supplying Israel, Bahrain, and Egypt. We've got about a minute left, Stephen. Now that this is getting so much attention and a lot of people, regardless of political affiliation, are really outraged by all of this, where do you see this going?
Well, I hope that this is the catalyst for reform. I hope that when we talk about this kind of thing and we talk about gun control, I hope that we recognize the core source of all of this is the is our country's policy on drugs, the war on drugs. We have created a horrible, horrible social situation in this country. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners, and all of this, the militarization of police, all of this stems from the war on drugs, and now, of course, the war on terror. And we need to stop and examine where we're going as a country, and relook at our Constitution. So I hope that this is the beginning of a long series of reforms.
Stephen Downing is retired LAPD deputy chief and board member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. G.W. Schultz is a reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. And Daniel Newman is president of MapLight, a nonprofit revealing money's influence on politics. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank
You're
you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What's needed to support young people who come from poor and low-income families? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with students who are defying the odds by graduating from college. Only 30% of low-income students enroll in college right after high school. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg recently committed $120 million to classroom technology in Bay Area schools. But what students say they really need are mentors. So what else do they need? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.